Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Eric LeMay, a host on the New Books Network. Today, I interview Marta Zaraska about her book, Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, 100? I'm not sure how appealing that is. Well, in our interview, Zaraska has a surprising response for you. And it's important to say at the outset that Zaraska's aim isn't really to show us just how to prolong our years, but to help us understand how every one of our days between now and, if we're lucky, 100 might be full and rich and immensely gratifying. And she helps us by taking us into the science of human thriving. What she discovers leads us not only to a better understanding of our own nature, but also to a deeper connection with one another. Marta Zaraska, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Eric.
I'm so glad that you're here, and I'm excited to talk about your new book, Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100. And so I would like to start off with a question that I think is going to surprise a lot of people. So everyone I know is doing something with their diet. They're watching what they eat or they're not eating something, and it is under this guise of health. And the wonderful thing about your book is that it shows us that this might be a very limited perspective on what we think about when we think about being healthy or well. So all those folks out there that are looking at their plates or their refrigerators so intensely, right? What is this vision that you have about maybe looking up for a moment?
So one important thing I want to start with is that I never say that diet and exercise are not important, because they are still important. Maybe certain things we do around dieting and exercise are not important, or at least far less important than we think. So for example, fad diets, supplements, some kind of miracle foods, some of them at best do nothing and some can actually hurt your health. But looking at the bigger picture, what I'm saying is that even though diet and exercise in general, healthy diet and some physical activity are important for your health, there are things that we often overlook while we are anxiously staring into our fridges. We forget about things that matter more for health and longevity. And there is so much research on this and has been around for quite a while, yet somehow it didn't make it to the public mind. And I'm talking here about things like friendship, quality of your romantic relationship, kindness, volunteering, your personality, whether you are neurotic, whether you are conscientious, for example, optimism, things like that, which actually have been shown in research to be even more important than diet and exercise. And just to show you some numbers, for example, generally in research, diet and exercise can lower your mortality risk if you do it well, so healthy diet and good exercise, can lower your mortality risk anywhere between 20 and 30%, which is quite a lot. But when you think about your social connection, for example, so having trusted friends, loving spouse, knowing your neighbors, if you have all these things going on, this can lower your mortality risk by even over 60%. So that's a huge difference it's far more important than your diet and exercise. Actually being socially connected is even more important than quitting smoking if you are a heavy smoker, which of course doesn't mean you should smoke, but it just gives you a perspective of how important these things are.
And I think one of the wonderful things about this book is that, I'll just take a step back. You are a science writer. So part of your approach is to delve into this research that a lot of us are not seeing, or that somehow it's not reaching a general public. Could you just tell us, just give us a glimpse of the amount of work you did that is the background of this book? I just want listeners to know how thoroughly documented it is.
So as you said yourself, I'm a science journalist and I've been a journalist for over 20 decades now. Two decades, 20 years, of course. And I write for Scientific American. I write for Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Discovery Magazine, New Scientist, and some other publications as well. And Growing Young is my second book. And the research that went to it was definitely, there was a lot of reading of scientific papers. I've read over 600 research papers to write Growing Young, and I've talked to dozens of scientists in a very from very varied disciplines, neuroscience, anthropology, marketing, Japan studies, lots and lots of different disciplines. And I had a lot of fun as well. I traveled as well for the book. I took part in some experiments. I helped catch wild mice in the forests around Oxford with some University of Oxford scientists. I did experiments on myself with help from scientists from King's College London. So it was fascinating all doing all this, and it did also change my life and the way I approach health and longevity myself.
So you had mentioned in your earlier answer that there's this, that somehow this research hasn't made it into our kind of collective awareness. Do you have any ideas about why it is? Before we get to the research itself and how it does seem to be so eye-opening, I'm wondering why, and here I know that you're a global citizen, so I'll keep referring to North America, where I can speak with a little more confidence, our eyes are sort of close to this awareness. Does it have something to do with preconceptions about the connection between the mind or body, or you know, is it because we think of health equals bodies? Mm-hmm. What is the?
I think there may be two reasons for that. And the first reason is that in generally in our Western culture these days, we really like things that are easy to measure, you know. When we're talking, for example, about healthy diet, we like to know that we've eaten our 100 grams or however that is in ounces of broccoli per day, that we've had enough of vitamin B12 or vitamin C, and we like to pop the supplement because it's just so easy to measure, so quantifiable, you know. Definitely the fact that there are so many apps out there that measure things for you. Your how many steps you've taken, for example. Has it been already 10,000 today or not yet? So it's really easy kind of to visualize, to measure, to be sure that you are doing your work on the path to a long and healthy life. Whereas we're talking about friendship or kindness or empathy or optimism, it's much harder to measure. You cannot say whether you've been kind enough today because you did 5 kind things, right? Because what if you did also 6 mean things? So also how good are your friendships? So these things are extremely important, but they don't fit into this cultural narrative where we measure things, then we have an app that helps us, you know, gain some badges for having certain amount of that thing. And then also we can post in our social media saying we've done the 10,000 steps. So it's a little bit different, right? And the second reason, perhaps even more important, is that there is no money in friendship or kindness and things like that. There is nobody selling you anything. There are no products out there that are being advertised to you. When we are thinking about diet, there are so many, you know, dietary supplements, some miracle foods that somebody's selling, fad diets and products that surround it, right? Then the same with health, all the gadgets or the apps or the exercise classes or all the, you know, health watches and so on. money is being made. And if money is being made, you are going to hear about those things. And whereas a walk with your friend is for free, and the same is, you know, making a tea for your coworker, the kind act is also for free. So that's why I believe it didn't make it really to the popular knowledge.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Thank you for that answer. Well, when you begin to take people into this research, where do you like to start? You know, now that you have a chance to talk to people outside of a kind of commercial exchange, or you're not communicating with them through an app that's quantifying their health, and you have them in front of you, what is a way you found to kind of open up this way of understanding our human relationships in regard to our health?
I mean, first of all, that's important thing to understand here, that there is nothing new agey about it. Sometimes people assume that when we are talking, you know, kindness or optimism, friendships, this sounds like a new agey stuff, right? But it's anything but. It's extremely biological, extremely physiological, and has been tested in research, both epidemiological research, also lab research on the level of cells and genes, and animal research, and randomized trials. So just, it's very, very physiological. And the reason for that is that we have evolved this way. When you think about it, you know, we are social apes. Just like our cousins, the chimpanzees, for instance, we need our tribe to function well. We evolve to be with others. And if we are not, then a lot of things happen and change in our body that have this downstream negative effects on our body. So for instance, you know, when you are lonely, that meant for our ancestors, usually being alone on the savanna. And that initiated a cascade of changes, hormonal changes in your body to prepare you for things that could happen when you are alone on the savannah. So for example, when you were in your tribe, you were much more likely to be infected with viruses, which, as we very well know these days, spread among other humans or other apes. Whereas when you are alone, you are much more likely to be wounded, for instance, by wild animals or having accidents. So when you are alone, your body starts to prepare you for bacterial infections, and to conserve energy, it dials down the antiviral response, since you are less likely to catch the virus, but upgrades the bacterial protection. So in modern terms, it's inflammation. So when we are alone these days, you know, we are usually alone, feeling alone in a very different way than our ancestors. We are not stranded on a savanna. We are feeling lonely in our apartments among crowds, and it's also usually very chronic. And this means that our bacterial response is chronically up. It means inflammation these days. And inflammation, as you may know, unfortunately leads to a lot of diseases that are a plague, you can say, these days. So for example, diabetes, cardiovascular problems, things like that, right? So in a way, all the systems that we evolved in the past to live in a tribe and to function the best, these days, very often, they misfire. They don't work the way they were supposed to. For example, our fight or flight response, which is also something that connects our bodies and our minds, doesn't function well because our stressors are very different than they used to be.
So you talk a little bit about stress in the book and the way in which... Could you just give us a kind of glimpse of like how something like the HPA axis works? You had mentioned the hormones, but it's just fascinating to see how the hormonal cocktail in your brain starts to make these huge bodily changes, which then register in terms of, you know, chronic disease or, you know, depression. So many of us are quite understandably stressed and lonely right now. What's happening in our brain?
So what happens when you're stressed, that you have this fight or flight response, as we commonly know it, and part of this is something, as you said, HPA axis or hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. It's a mouthful for something that connects basically your brain with the cascade of hormones that get released in your body. So when you get stressed by something, in the past it would have been lion creeping upon you on a savanna. Today it can be your mortgage that needs to be paid. And your hypothalamus in your brain gets the message. And then a cascade of hormones get released. Basically, one hormone prompts a release of another hormone, and so on and so on. Some of them involve, for example, cortisol or adrenaline, so things that we may commonly know, cortisol, the stress hormone. And then, you know, if it gets normally in the savannah, this would calm down very fast because the stressor would go away, let's say the lion, and everything will calm down, the systems will get back to normal. But unfortunately, these days, our stressors are very kind of low burning, but often chronic. So this HPA axis doesn't function the way it should. And it's kind of turned on a low level permanently. So for example, the cortisol and the stress hormone will become dysregulated. And when it's not functioning well, it has a lot of downstream effects on our body. In, for example, the way fat gets metabolized in our body with all the downstream consequences for our cardiovascular system, for instance. But the stress response is not the only thing that connects our social lives and our mind life, you could say, with our body. There is also a lot of so-called social hormones. For instance, oxytocin, which is often called the laugh hormone, or serotonin, vasopressin, endorphins. These are all hormones that get released when we are in contact with other people. For example, when you are holding hands with someone, you can get oxytocin. When you are dancing with other people, you can get endorphins. And on one hand, these hormones give us all these feelings, for example, of being connected, of trusting other people. But on the other hand, they also have very strictly physiological effects. So oxytocin, for instance, it has effects on your bone growth. It can prevent osteoporosis. Endorphins are natural painkillers, while serotonin has impact on our liver, for instance. So they have on one hand this kind of emotional effects, but on the other, very physiological effects directly on our health.
That's wonderful. I can imagine a listener hearing you talk and saying, okay, so, you know, I think about my body and I think about what I eat and I think about, you know, whether I exercise or not and how much sleep I get. How does one begin to think in a scientific or practical way about my capacity for empathy or the quality of my friendship or whether or not I'm mindful? I mean, what does that vision of one's life look like?
I think it's first of all about changing your perspective and realizing that those things are extremely important for your health. And once you see them like this, you start incorporating them into your life. And I think that somewhere deep inside, we all know whether our marriage is happy, whether our friendships are good enough, whether we are kind enough. You don't have to measure everything. Sometimes you just know, right? Maybe there are some people who would have problems defining the quality of their friendships. But I think most of us can say, yes, I have good friends, or I don't have, you know, good enough friendships and I need more. This is also something that people often ask me. They say, how many friends do I need to be good enough, right, to live long? And this is the same question I actually asked to Professor Robin Dunbar at the University of Oxford. That's the anthropologist who also invented the Dunbar number, that how many friends we can have. And so he told me that it really depends. For some people, it can be one person, one friend. For another person, it needs to be three. And for another person, may need as many as seven really close friends. And you know where you are. For example, if you have just one really good friend and you feel that this is all you need, that all your needs are being met, that you can really connect, that you know this person will be there for you, that you can tell them all your secrets, all the thoughts and feelings that you have and share everything, then you are fine. But there will be another person for whom even three friends won't be enough and they'll need five because this is where their needs are being met. What is definitely not fine if you have zero good friends. And unfortunately, a lot of Americans are there these days that they have not a single person in whom they could confide. Actually, the number is 25%. So a quarter of Americans don't have a single friend in whom they can confide. And this is really bad for your health. But as long as you do have very close friends, the number is not that important as, you know, just having them and the frequency also of your meeting. So you have to see your friends. If you have a good friend but you never see them, this is also not good for you.
I'm just going to do a little side swerve and say, do you have advice as someone who's gone through this research and made changes in her own life about how to handle this moment of quarantine and worry when you can't perhaps hold the hand of a friend or be in their presence?
I mean, so first of all, you have to, you know, look around you. Maybe there are people with whom you can safely have this kind of relationship, and maybe you are not doing it enough. So maybe you live already with someone, either a roommate or your romantic partner, your children, and just make sure that the quality of the relationship is there. So, you know, sometimes people can live under the same roof and not really spend the quality time. Make sure that exactly you hug each other, that you hold hands, that you look into each other's eyes, that the quality of the relationship is really there. And if you don't, if you live alone, then there are still ways to connect, and some of them are better than others. For example, there is actual research showing that texting is not really good for you. So for instance, if you call someone, it can be just a regular phone, doesn't have to be video calling, but I would assume video would be even better. But the research was on just regular calls. If you hear the word of the other, the voice of the other person, you get a much larger release of oxytocin, so this love hormone, than if you get exactly the same message over a text, which means basically that stop texting and start calling people, because hearing the voice is really important. And as we know from before, oxytocin also has very direct effects on your health. It also, for example, has anti-inflammatory properties. It also reduces pain. And there are even some connections with your immune system. So it's really important to connect as physically as we can in this kind of situations.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Could you tell us a little bit? So the kind of goal that's in your subtitle, right, is about longevity and aging. And of course, the implied view that you have is you just don't simply want to stay alive, right? You want to have a certain kind of quality and robustness and vivacity of life. So how do you think about what it means to age? Mm-hmm. How do you measure that with this idea of quality, not just, you know, I'm a biotic entity that made it to 106 years?
Yeah, so sometimes when people hear exactly the subtitle of my book, which is exactly, you know, how friendship, optimism, kindness can help you live to 100, they tell me, but I don't want to live to 100. So the thing is that it's a common misunderstanding that if you live to 100, you will spend your last 3 or 4 decades being infirm and, you know, frail. Of course, it does happen sometimes, but this is more of a exception than a rule. Actually, research shows that while a typical person who lives to be, let's say, about 80, will spend 18% of their time on Earth ridden by disease, while for people who are super centenarians, so those who live to be 110 or more, that's only 5%. And 1 out of 10 of those super centenarians actually escapes disease until the very last 3 months of their life. So just imagine that you live to be, you know, 110 and you only are infirm for 3 months. This is absolutely amazing. And the reason for that is the things that make you live long also basically are the same things that make you stay healthy. So just the same as with diet and exercise, good diet, you know, prolongs your life, but it also prolongs your health. So of course you will hear about someone's grandma who, you know, spent 4 decades in bed, but this is more or less the same kind of story as, you know, my grandpa smoked a packet a day until he was 97 and he never had cancer. It is an exception more than a rule.
So you hit on so many fascinating things in the book, from, you know, empathy and attachment to, you know, ideas of happiness to meditation and mindfulness. When you did these travels, when you participated in self experiments, what stood out to you is sort of these moments where you thought, ah, here's where this research really meshed with my own experience? That because you're a mother, you have a spouse, so you're living a life that many of us are living and having the kinds of relationships that we have. Where did you see the research just suddenly opening up in your own life?
I mean, the most fascinating thing I think I've done when I was researching Growing Young was this kind of experiment that I did with cooperation with King's College London. And I say kind of experiment because, you know, a sample of one that's not very scientific. But I was basically reproducing the same methodology or the same kind of experiment that was done before on much larger samples. And what we've done was that we were basically trying to find out how acts of kindness in everyday life impact cortisol, so the stress hormone, which, as we know, also is extremely important for our health. We've designed an experiment where over a period of a week, I would measure my cortisol levels 3 times a day. It involved basically chewing all these horrible cotton swabs in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. It was absolutely disgusting. I didn't expect that for sure. And then I would collect the samples and keep them in the fridge until the experiment was over, and then I shipped them to UK. At the same time, I had randomly chosen certain days. There were 3 days like that, or my intervention days, where I engaged in a lot of kindness. So I would sit in the morning and make a list of nice things I could do that day. So for example, I would bake cookies and so that my husband could take them to work and share them with his coworkers. Or I picked up trash around my neighborhood, or I left a smiley post-it note on my neighbor's car. You know, small things like that, just, or let even somebody ahead of me in traffic, but just make sure to be as kind as I could over those 3 days. Whereas the other 4 days, I just lived my life as usual. And afterwards, when the scientists calculated the levels of my cortisol, how it changed over the span of each day, they could really clearly see on the graphs which days were my kindness days. And bizarrely, even though one of my kindness days was particularly stressful for me for personal reasons, it really didn't show up on my cortisol response. It was still very healthy despite all the real stress that I was under, which basically showed us that the kindness offset all the potential stress and really improved their response on the level of my cortisol. But we were all really fascinated to just see it so clearly on the graphs.
Did your personal emotional experience of those days map onto the data? Did you feel differently on your kindness days than you did on your regular days?
So definitely it was a lot of fun to do that kindness. It was just pleasurable to just sit down and think about it. But as I've mentioned before, one of those days was really stressful. I was feeling very anxious. It was something completely unrelated to the experiment. And yet it didn't affect my body in the way it normally probably would have if I wasn't doing all the kindness.
So is this... how does this link up with this idea of mindfulness and meditation and yoga? Or even you can tell us about the yoga rats. That would be great, right? You know, where you have there, at least, you know, in America, this is sort of understood as this is this moment where I'm going to take over my emotional life by calming down and, you know, emptying out, and this will have, you know, an overall effect. You know, so thinking of kind of kindness and yoga in the same room, or kindness and meditation in the same room, and is there a difference? Do they overlap? Do they complement one another?
Mm-hmm. So they definitely complement one another. So, you know, mindfulness can make us better at relationships. Mindfulness has been shown to improve marriage, for instance. It can make us also be more kind. There is loving kindness meditation that can then help us be more kind in our everyday life. But if you were, just to put things into perspective, if you were to do only one thing, then certainly mindfulness meditation per se wouldn't be it. If you were, for example, to sacrifice your friendships for your mindfulness or yoga sessions, this is not the way to go, because even though mindfulness is important for our health, it's not as important as your friendships or your marriage. So just to put in things into perspective, but it is really good for you as well. So the yoga rats that you mentioned before, these were lab rodents that were tested in experiments where they were basically forced to breathe more slowly. They were put into a contraption that basically taught them how to, with blinking lights, how to breathe more slowly than usual. And after they started breathing more slowly, some of them were put into very stressful, and again, equipment, which has a very wicked sounding name, rodent restrainer, which is basically this kind of claustrophobic tube where they're held for 10 minutes and is generally very stressful for rats. And you could see in the experiment that those rats who were trained to breathe more slowly, so kind of in this mindful yoga way, you could say, experienced less stress on a physiological level than those who didn't undergo this kind of training.
Well, that's fascinating. Could you tell us a little bit about what empathy looks like through your research? This is something, I'm a teacher of literature, and we talk about that a lot, that, you know, books create empathy. And so it was very fascinating for me to encounter this vision and understanding of empathy that works in yours and how, you know, it works interpersonally and biologically and hormonally. So tell us a little bit about empathy, what it does, why we should foster it, especially it's a very divisive time in the United States in which it seems empathy is shutting down all around. Could you speak to us a little bit about the role of empathy and why it matters?
I mean, certainly, you know, some even talk about empathy crisis, and you could really see it in research, you know, that empathy has plummeted in the West, which is definitely a very bad thing, both for our society and for our health. On the other hand, as you've said yourself, books are one of the great ways in which we can learn empathy, especially this kind of very emotional books where you can really identify with the main character, right? To see the world through their eyes, because this is basically what empathy training is, to try to see the world through the eyes of another person. Good movies can also teach you empathy in a similar way. When I was writing Growing Young, I took a part in empathy training of children. There is this amazing Canadian organization called The Roots of Empathy. And basically they go to schools with this program where they take a mother with a small baby, and the school children have 1 hour sessions over a certain period of several weeks where they visit with the baby, where they observe the baby grow and have to identify the emotions when the baby, for example, starts crying because it gets frustrated. So they have to see why the baby gets frustrated. How did the mother respond? They have to really try to see the world through the eyes of the baby. And this is exactly what empathy is, seeing the world through the eyes of another person. And even though part of how empathetic we are is genetic, so you inherit it from your parents, but it's only part of it. And a large part is still something that we can develop and learn. I often compare empathy to exercise. You know, we are all born with with different muscles, right? For example, I will never be Usain Bolt. And it doesn't mean I'm not trying to exercise. I'm not trying to run faster or longer, for instance, right? And the same thing is with empathy. Even though you might have been born with not the most empathetic setup, you can still really work on it and develop and become much more empathetic, which is very important for our health, both directly and also through improving our relationships, our contact with others, our kindness, and all the other things we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Do you imagine some sort of empathy intervention that would help the West tremendously on an adult level?
I mean, there are interventions like that, you know, there are interventions with like medical students or prisoners and so on, but there is also an amazing project. It's called the Human Library. I don't know if you've heard about it, but instead of books, you can actually rent humans. So you come to this human library and there are lots of different people there from very different backgrounds. So there can be a refugee, for example, or I don't know, a policeman, or just very, very different people. Maybe somebody, a transsexual person, very different people from, you know, for example, from me or you. And you can rent them, to talk with them, and just have a nice chat and just learn about their lives and try to see how their lives are different from yours. So this is exactly a great way to learn empathy, just to try to step outside of yourself and see the world from the perspective of a very different person.
I love how the metaphor of the library gets used. It makes the empathy that comes through someone else's story become literalized by getting to meet someone else directly. Well, so there are some surprising it's full of surprising moments. I want to make sure that listeners hear that. Each page you kind of turn and you go, whoa, which is part of the fun of the book. But things that you perhaps wouldn't think by default are good for you turn out to be so, like working till you drop, as you call it. You know, we think I'm going to retire and then I'll finally get to take care of myself and I won't have the stresses of work and I'll be free. But this doesn't seem to bear out in the research and the data that you've encountered.
I mean, just to clarify, it really also depends on your work. If your work is absolutely horrible, then definitely retirement will be better for you. But what this basically research shows is that retirement is not necessarily good for you. It's really, you know, for some people, especially if they retire in this way that they just, you know, spend their days on the couch and watch Netflix the whole day, that's not a good thing. Because the thing about work is what it gives us is social connection on one hand, and also some kind of meaning, and this is supposed to give us some meaning and some reason to get up in the morning. And if by retiring you lose it and you don't replace it with anything else, another reason to get up in the morning, another reason, something to give back to your community, another way to connect with other people, then indeed it can be bad for your health. So this is something I also discovered when I was researching growing young in Japan, because they are famously, you know, not very much into retiring the way we are. They even have something they call silver hair employment agencies, and basically these are employment agencies for elderly people, where after retiring from your regular job in marketing or sales or whatever, you can come to the silver hair retirement agency and get a job that's easy, usually part-time, and also usually something that really is connected to giving back to the community. So for example, you can be a gardener of public spaces, or you can be helping children cross streets on the way to school. And they don't do it really for the money. They do it exactly to be involved, to be engaged, to be still useful. And research does show that this kind of engagement really, really helps people stay healthy longer. And of course, it can be simply volunteering. You don't have to be paid for it, Japanese style, but just to do something, not just sit on your couch with Netflix on.
Yeah, that seems horrid. That seems like another version of, you know, being in a hospital bed for four decades. Can you tell us a little bit about the journey of your own work as an author? You began, and I remember fondly talking about a book called Meat Hooked, which was about diet, which was about our sort of Western obsession with meat. And then you kind of moved, as you yourself said, out of just thinking about diet and exercise and what we're doing with our bodies to this larger vision of what it really means to be a thriving person, which involves your relationships, your emotional states, basically your human interactions. Where are you heading now in your work?
So I'm already writing my third book, and I cannot say too much about it. I think it's still kind of a trade secret, but it is in a similar spirit to Growing Young. So kind of an optimistic and hopefully, you know, hope building kind of type of book, but it's actually on climate change, which kind of, I know that those two things, optimistic and climate change, usually don't go together. And I'm, of course, absolutely not denying climate change. I'm just showing how it can have positive impacts on how we change as a society. So this is something I'm working on right now.
Well, I think one of the things that's wonderful about your work is it does change the common default narrative of how we understand things, whether it's our human relationships or the way in which we consume. And so I think having a narrative by you out there of what it might mean to understand climate change will be useful and apt for all of us.
I hope so.
Well, I also hope that when you do publish it, you'll come back and talk to us.
I would certainly love to.
Marta, thank you so much for being on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Eric.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Marta Zaroska, author of Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100, here on the New Books Network.